From the heart of the Forest City, Blackburn Media presents the Craig Needles Podcast, looking at the biggest stories in London and around the world and how they impact you. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Tuesday edition of the Craig Needles Podcast here on LondonNewsToday.ca, ClassicRock981.com, all the big podcatchers, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you are listening and downloading. We thank you very much for doing that. We hope you continue to do so. We very much appreciate it. And wherever you are, I hope that you're safe, you're feeling good, because I do want to start by very briefly talking about the big news from this week, which is school will be returning on the 17th of January. And I tweeted this out last night, and I got people angry at me on both sides of the ledger, and I'll say it again. Every concern that someone may bring forward here is valid. Did the province of Ontario, did the government screw up here? Did the Ministry of Education screw up by not doing enough to make schools a safer, better place to be back in the summer of 2021 when things were relatively calm? Yes, of course they did. HEPA filters, better masking, testing programs, all those things should have been there. No doubt in my mind. No dispute. However, does it suck when kids are out of school? Yes. Is that bad for children? Not in every case, but in a lot of cases, yes. There are some students that I'm sure love remote learning and that helps them learn. They learn better and that's great. And I'm not saying that doesn't exist. But on a majority basis here, especially with the younger crowd, it's going to be a positive thing for education that students and peers will be back in a couple weeks. Now, how long will this last? Did the government do the right things here? All these debates are worthwhile, and there are people who are going to have legitimate points about it. But I am having a tough time, a very tough time with two different camps. One, the people that will tell you that, oh, everyone's being too afraid and you're too fearful, you're buying the media hype, blah, 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 you're buying the healthcare, blah, 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 blah. No, those people are wrong. If someone's got concerns about this, those concerns are absolutely valid. Here's the other side that I have a problem with, and this is what was in my Twitter mentions last night. If you're angry at parents and kids because, hey, some parents are going to send kids back to school, sorry, you've just got to find someone else to be mad at. Because there's a lot of kids that need school. There's a lot of parents that are frustrated because they know their kids need school. You have to just find someone else to vent your anger towards. You want to be mad at a politician? Great. Do that. And hey, if you want to vent your anger towards me as someone in the media, you don't like what I'm saying, that's fine too. But going after parents because, well, why are you sending your child back to school? Nah, sorry, don't do that. That's a little excessive for me. Find another place to vent. Now, what we're dealing with right now, what we're dealing with in this moment is not great. Perhaps we're at the peak of this because of the lack of testing ability. Really don't know. So there's some uncertainty to come. And hey, will schools even open Monday? I don't know if I'd bet everything I own on that. There's a chance they change their minds about it. But for now, this is the situation we're in, and we will break it down more on Friday when we know more and we've heard from Education Minister Stephen Lecce, who's been somewhat absent for the last little while, but apparently he's going to be doing a news conference later in the week. And if you're listening to this on a Wednesday afternoon, you may have already done it. We will have full analysis of that news conference on this podcast on Friday. For now, though, I want to start by talking with Dave Gilmore, who is the president of the London Police Association. You might remember a story from just a little while back that the London Police Association had a vote of no confidence in the chief of police, Steve Williams. But there wasn't really a lot of comment as far as what the reasoning behind that was. Dave, thank you so much for doing this. Dave Gilmore, the president of the London Police Association. Glad to have you on the podcast.
No problem. Thanks for taking the time, Craig.
We got a story last month, towards the end of the year, about members of the London Police Association having a non-confidence vote about the chief of police, Steve Williams. And you told me at the time, hey, you wanted to wait a little bit and get the feedback from your entire membership and then talk about it. Have you had a chance to do that yet? And what do we have to say about what happened?
Okay, the process is essentially completely played out now. So I can give you some background. I can give you some information surrounding how we've arrived at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And basically where we stand now and where we're looking to do moving forward. Does that seem like a logical way to
I think that's
this?
A fantastic way to do it. So let's talk about how we got here.
Okay. This is a byproduct of, I would say, many years, almost decades of systemic issues within policing in general and London specifically. Going back into the 90s, a lot of services were downloaded from the provincial government onto municipalities, which then fell upon the police. Police have been scrambling for resources ever since. And then there's just been all kinds of other social issues that have exacerbated the problem over time. Police budgets have been trying to catch up. We did a deep dive about 20 years ago into our staffing levels. I know I was part of the, we called it a workload analysis committee. It was very technical. There was, a very deep dive into how we conduct business and the time on calls, all that type of thing. At the time, we identified that we needed 150 new officers. It was determined that was never going to get through, a budget exception at City Hall, and we ended up getting 85 officers. So we've essentially been running probably 60, 70 officers short of where we needed to be 20 years ago. And we went through budget processes for many years where we had to essentially go to City Hall every year and make the case for new resources. Now that all changed in 2015. At the time, there was a big push by the chief of the day, John Perret, and our current chief, Steve Williams, who at the time was the budget chair, to tie the police budget to assessment growth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Okay,
and I know that politicians talked about that making sense as well, and it's I remember the conversations.
Okay, so since 2015, as the city grows exponentially, so does the police department. So essentially, over the last 7 years, we've been growing and not losing ground like we had been for many years. So now we're just in a point where the only reason that this police service, which according to benchmarking data, which we could go through, but I mean, it is what it is. We're one of the lowest cost police services in, a major city in the country. And we have significantly fewer officers than a lot of other services per 100,000 people. So like everything over time, you just reach a breaking point. So I think last summer, whether it was a combination of COVID, Bill C-75, the additional downloading of services, and it's just, we reached our breaking point where we did not have enough officers on the front line. We had implemented minimum staffing language into our working agreement, whereby if we don't have enough officers, they put it out for officers to come and work overtime. But officers have been doing this for a number of years. A lot of them are just burned out. They will no longer work overtime, because they want to have some time with their families, obviously. And last summer, we were at a point where on any given day, there was 200 calls in the queue. That's the active calls for service. So officers would be coming in every day. And a lot of days had been going from emergency call to emergency call all day long. A lot of times not getting relief. Looking for solutions, and solutions were not forthcoming. There weren't enough people. Not enough people were hiring on. And in the fall, a number of officers, you have to keep in mind, police officers are very dedicated, very conservative. They generally don't do anything too rash. So a number of officers put together what they called a call for action. They asked the chief to make some changes, address frontline issues. It was signed by almost 100 frontline members, and they gave it to myself and our executive director, and we presented it to the executive of the police service. They took it under consideration, and then that's what led to the changes in relation to the two most obvious ones were the disbandment of the community-oriented response unit and the putting the school resource officers were doing on an enhanced service unit, doing calls from the police station, not physically on the road, but answering calls for service instead of dealing with school issues. We got to a point where these things have started to, you know, have a bit of an effect, but I think it had just boiled over to the point where officers saw, you know, nothing's getting done. And it seems like it's, you know, we're always robbing Peter to pay Paul and reallocating resources around the service, and every area of the service, you know, is stressed for resources. And so they came to a meeting and indicated that they had no confidence in the chief and called for a vote. And a majority of the people voted in favor of it. And that's where we're at. As of today.
So what does that mean going forward then for how the association relates to management then?
What do you mean? In what regard?
So, you know, you have to have conversations. You have to have a working relationship with the chief, right? So
absolutely.
The fact that this has occurred, does that alter that relationship at all?
The association has been working with the Police Services Board and the administration to try and garner more resources. And, you know, it's just got to the point where it wasn't happening fast enough. And, you know, I think we now either have to, you know, everybody talks about reimagining policing. Well, I think we're at a point where we're going to have to reimagine how we deliver service and what type of calls for service that we actually go to and what are, you know, police matters as opposed to what are social matters that should be handled by other government agencies. And, you know, the members, the association will work with the administration, but I think people are past the point of waiting for change to occur. So there have been some things that have occurred in the last few weeks with relation to the type of calls for service that we will attend and we will no longer attend, but there's a new calls for service committee, and I know some frontline officers have been invited onto that, and they're doing a an analysis of what are the big drivers of our time and what we should and should not be attending. So that's moving forward. I think we have an opportunity here for a few months because the big issue is next May, June, people are going to start taking holidays again because you want to have summer holidays with your family. And that's when we'll be stressed for resources again. Calls for service go up in the summer. And, you know, we have other issues. One of the biggest ones is, you know, Bill C-75. So, you know, we consistently catch people committing serious crimes, and they're literally out the next day committing more serious crimes. And it doesn't matter how many times you lock them up, they just get released. And that's beyond the control of the police service and the police association, no matter how much we do in relation to, you know, advocacy at the provincial or federal level. Those decisions occur beyond where we can control them.
And, you know, you mentioned one that's going to be high profile, and we'll talk about it right now, but this guy, Saranjeet Singh, who keeps getting bail over and over again, and there's concern, obviously, as far as how he's, what he might do to a woman in the community because he continually harasses them. This guy is facing many, many counts of criminal harassment charges. Like, that's just one example, but I understand the frustration from the perspective of your members. Now, there's nothing the chief can do about that, nothing the board can do about that, but I understand the frustration.
Well, that's one small, more public example.
I know there are others too, of course.
Oh, yeah. And the bigger ones are, at what point in time do we stop doing things that don't have any value for society? For example, there are numerous people in the city who unfortunately have substance abuse issues, and, you know, they will walk into an LCBO on any given day and there's security guards there. They won't be stopped. They will shoplift and walk out, and then the LCBO contacts the police, so our enhanced service unit gets video, and then they charge these people, then the charges are withdrawn. This is a daily occurrence, and it's just, you know, at what point in time do we realize that there's no value to society to do that? And if the LCBO isn't, you know, they're not going to stop them because of risk issues in the store, then, you know, is that really a police issue?
Yeah, and one could argue it's not, because if they're not still on the grounds of the store, then what are you going to be able to do about it?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there's so many examples of, you know, officers could be out there doing proactive policing or, they could respond in more emergent calls for service in a timely fashion if we weren't dealing with all of this other, you know, administrative and, you know, calls for service that are not so emergent.
Yeah, I understand that one. Here's the other one I want to ask you about, and I'm going to talk about this in the podcast later in the week, but the mental health aspect of things. Essentially, police officers have to serve as a mental health crisis response team. Now, I know that advocates say that's a bad idea. I know that, you know, police union heads like yourself say that's a bad idea. Police chiefs say that's a bad idea, yet we're still doing it. And that's something that frustrates me. And I think that we should all be able to agree that, hey, we've got to figure out something else for this because it leads to way too many calls for services. And then the resources that we have in policing are stretched thin. And officers that are in the London Police Association are not doing what they're trained to do. They're being mental health experts instead, which is not what they're trained to be.
Right. Well, there's a long history around this. So in the mid-90s, have you been in London long enough to remember when the London Psychiatric Hospital was open?
I have actually family members who worked there, but before, it was before I moved to London. But yeah, I know the location.
Okay. Well, it was a wonderful inpatient facility. It was very well run. Many of the police officers had a good relationship with the, it was basically run by charge nurses, but a lot of the people who are now in our community with severe mental health issues were in inpatient treatment. So for cost-saving reasons, they were placed in outpatient treatment. Well, what happens is a lot of these people get out in the community and they don't take their medication, they don't have family or anybody to advocate for them. And then they become a point where they become a danger to themselves or others. And then, you know, community treatment orders are issued, which means the police have to go hunt them down and take them to a hospital or psychiatric facility. And then they're in getting remedicated. And again, it's just a revolving door. Police absolutely should not be dealing with mental health. And if you follow in the media, the number of people who, you know, say they want to reimagine police and they want social workers to go out there. Well, policing is a front-facing 24/7, 365 day a year job where we deal with people in severe crisis all day long. And, you know, you would have to probably make some new arm of government where you're going to have social workers that are going to go out and deal with these things. And you also can't have social workers dealing with violent situations because, you know, these situations have to be de-escalated before you can even begin to deal with the underlying issues, whether it be mental health, substance abuse, homelessness, on and on it goes.
Yeah, and that's the part that frustrates me. And look, I don't know exactly what the solution is. I don't know exactly what the fix is, but it feels as though this is something that municipal politicians want. Like I said, police chiefs want it. Association heads want it. Mental health advocates want it. It just feels like this is something that everyone's pushing for. And we've got to get there because what we have right now is simply not sustainable. And I think everyone should agree with that.
Well, it's not sustainable. And it's now to the point where the officers are, you know, officers are having a hard time coming into work every day, seeing the sheer volume of, you know, calls for service. And it's not sustainable from an officer mental health aspect and from an officer burnout perspective, because you can't come into work every day and, you know, work well above your capabilities. You know, you can do it for a day here, a day there. But, you know, we all need a day every now and then where you're just working in a normal pace. And these people have been working at an elevated pace for so long that they're just getting fed up and burned out. And, you know, you're seeing the results of that now.
Yeah. And that's frustrating. So what kind of conversations do you have with your members about that? You said you wanted to ask the membership about it when you did. What did they say?
By and large, members would like to see the type of calls and the number of calls for service reduced by, you know, taking a look at how we respond to calls and what calls we respond to. So, you know, I'm not going to get into specifics, but in the last couple of weeks, we've had orders come out in relation to three different types of calls that we will no longer be investigating. And that's having a marginal impact at this point in time. It seems to be mitigating some calls. Also, we have We have a big issue around dealing with the hospitals. We used to have to submit a, you know, you arrest somebody who under the Mental Health Act, or you apprehend them, I would say you arrest them, but you take them to the nearest psychiatric facility, which is generally the hospital, and officers have to wait a long time, but we have to fill in a mental health assessment form, which takes a significant amount of time, and it's one of those ones that the hospital doesn't even really look at. So it's been a bone of contention back and forth for a number of years, and we've now just eliminated that. So, you know, it might save the officer in a half an hour filling out that form, but then, you know, the officer could still potentially be stuck at the hospital because the hospital doesn't have the staff to take over and secure this person while they assess them. Because once they're admitted to the hospital, they become, they're in the custody of the hospital and no longer in the place. So if you've ever seen the pictures of, you know, 10 police cars sitting out front of the emergency area at LHSC on Commissioner's Road, that's just a byproduct of all the mental health issues and the lack of resources at every level.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. And that's something, it's a societal wide issue because there are people that are regularly appearing at these hospitals that are not getting the help they need when they go, and then they have to go back and they may have an incident the police have to respond to on the way back the second time. And it's just, it's a really bad cycle that we're in.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's a revolving door issue too, right? Because we deal with the same people over and over and over again. And, you know, police officers deal with so many situations in a day where there's, you know, violence or the potential for violence. And, you know, we de-escalate 99.99% of all these incidents. But all it takes is one incident, and then everybody's criticizing the police. And everybody's saying, well, we should have more resources for mental health. We should have more resources for hospital. We should have more resources for outreach. I agree. We need all those things. But as many people say it, nobody has any solutions for it. So it always leaves the police holding the bag at the end of the day. And that is the big issue that we're facing. And that's why we're in this staffing crisis.
Yeah, and that's the... that's the question as far as how that gets resolved, because look, politically right now, budgets are stretched because of the aforementioned pandemic. So it may be a tough sell to get more officers onto the London Police Service, right?
Yeah. So that's a two-pronged issue. It depends on what the priorities of the city are. We already no longer have a community-oriented response unit, but, you know, and I can make it available to you or email it to you, but if you look at all the benchmarking data, London has not prioritized policing or safety to the extent that other cities have. I'm not saying they don't place a priority on it. Definitely not to the level that other cities have. I'm not really sure where London stands on, you know, the average taxation compared to other cities. But, you know, policing is a big line item on the city budget, and they spend significantly less than pretty much every other major municipality in the country. So, you know, London's getting very good value for its dollar, but they're doing it on the backs of the goodwill of the police officers. And that's basically coming to an end because officers have had it. And as dedicated as they are, this situation probably could have come to a head a year or two ago. And I think it's a testament to the hard work and dedication of my members that this is just coming to the forefront now. But if the city, and I'm not specifying anybody here, is not dedicating the resources that other municipalities are, they're not placing the same emphasis on public safety as other cities are. So they need to determine what type of city they want to have. So, you know, what calls for service do you want the police to come to? If it's a bylaw call, the police shouldn't be responding to that. You have a bylaw office, and it doesn't matter that they only work a certain number of hours a day. I think we've reached our breaking point. Our breaking point has now been passed. And so one way or another, policing in London is going to be reimagined.
The Police Services Board here in the City of London and the Chief of Police with London Police, what would, if they say, hey, Dave, what can we do to make the lives of our officers better? What can we do to sort of, if you want to use the term, restore confidence in leadership at London Police? What would your response to that be?
Well, two-part response. I know they have an initiative to hire more direct hires from other services. That being said, that's not easy because police officers are at a premium in this province. A lot of services are in crisis because they're severely understaffed. I can name a couple, but it doesn't matter. And it takes a lot. I mean, you just can't call a temp agency and get a police officer to get somebody, you know, apply, go through the process, go through background, go through police college. It takes almost a year to put a barely functioning police officer on the street. So, you know, staffing is something that takes time. I think the officers would like to see the type of calls and the variety of calls that we are responding to change, because they no longer have time for all the administrative calls and the downloads from other agencies. And I think we're at the point where we need to reimagine, but we need to reimagine from a point of, we're not going to service these calls anymore because we don't have the resources. That's what I think would help.
Okay. Well, that'll be some interesting conversations ahead, I would suspect. Anything else you want to add, Dave, before we wrap up our chat here?
No, I'd just like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on your show.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I appreciate that. And this will, I'm really glad that you could do that. And this, I think, will serve as a good piece of information for those in the community. So thank you very much for doing this with me. I appreciate the time.
Hey, thanks, Craig. Take care.
That's Dave Gilmore, president of the London Police Association, here on the Craig Needles podcast. We'll pause very, very briefly. But on the other side, we're going to be talking with Jeff Urich, who is the MPP for Elgin Middlesex London, at least for a little while longer. Jeff will soon no longer have that role at the end of February. He's announced that he's going to be resigning. Last week he made that announcement. We'll talk with Jeff on the other side of this. It's the Craig Needles podcast here on LondonNewsToday.ca. And as promised, we are joined by the member of Provincial Parliament for Elgin Middlesex London for at least a little while longer, Jeff Urich, joining us here on the Craig Needles podcast. Jeff, thanks so much for doing this. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to speak with you again.
Yeah, let's talk about first this decision. An election's coming up in June. You could have hung on till then and gone out that way, but instead you decide to leave in February. What was the thought process behind that choice?
Yeah, it's something that we've been discussing, my family and some friends and constituents over the last little while of whether it's time to leave or not. And, you know, around Christmas time, we made the final decision that it was best I don't run again. And, you know, you get that feeling inside you when it's time to move on from a position. And we thought we'd make the announcement as soon as possible. The problem was the province announced all these lockdowns at the start of January. So I waited a few days to you know, give space to that. And, you know, decided to close up shop end of February. You know, that'll leave open some time for the party as they're preparing for the next election. That'll be the focus in the upcoming session of the legislature. The budget bill will probably be the campaign document. And that'll get me out of the way of, you know, knowing that I won't be in the election. That'll just give up opportunity for the people at Queen's Park to prepare for the election.
And that's obviously part of what's going to be going on here. Now, you're leaving at a time where it's, you know, it's not been easy for someone in government. And I don't think you would have expected when you were reelected in 2018 to have this be sort of the backdrop of the entire term, almost this pandemic. What has it been like to be a provincial representative during this entire ordeal?
Yeah, you know, it's not something we signed up for at 2018 when we formed government or any other MPPs were elected. It's been quite an experience over the last 2 years. A lot of stress. Things change daily. You have to react. You have to get the message out to people. You got to help when they need support, either accessing supports, getting some information, sending them to the right place for guidance. So it has been quite a stressful period, not only for myself, but my wonderful constituency team. Who have, you know, I think they've gone above board at helping people get through this pandemic. I know we're not quite there. I'm hopeful that this current wave drops fairly quickly in the next few weeks.
I'm hopeful too. We'll see. We've got reports about schools being opened up officially again on the 17th. Not going to necessarily ask you to comment on that, but do you think that's a good idea if that were to happen?
You know, if they have cleared it way with the chief medical officer of health and medical officials to get schools open, I don't think there's anyone in this province that is wanting schools to be closed. So, you know, that's probably good news for a lot of parents. As a parent myself, my daughter's in grade 12. I want her in school like everyone else. And let's hope that, you know, things turn out well once they return next week.
I hope so very much as well. I want to ask you about the reaction to your decision here. I'm going to read you a tweet from the Ontario Liberal Party War Room. They quote tweeted your statement. You've probably seen this, and it says, leaving office just months before an election, not a single mention of at Ford Nation, trouble in caucus paradise. What is your relationship like with the premier?
I think my relationship is fairly decent with the premier. I've said this to numerous people that said I didn't mention him at all in my farewell. Is my time in politics has been about the people of Elgin, Middlesex, London, not any particular leader. It wasn't about Patrick Brown or Tim Hudak. I wanted to thank the people who put me in this position. It was an honor to serve, and that's what my farewell is all about. It had nothing to do with my relationship with the premier.
Okay, fair enough. And you say you think you have a pretty good relationship with the premier. What's it like compared to relationships with leaders past? You mentioned Tim Hudak, you mentioned Patrick Brown.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Hudak was my first leader, just getting into politics and understanding various roles. I had a great respect working with Tim Hudak. I still talk to him from time to time. Patrick Brown, I think I got along the best with him during his time as leadership. He was pretty open to my thoughts and ideas. I still have some good communication with Patrick being mayor of Brampton. And Doug Ford, you know, I've worked with him over the past 3 years, still getting to know him. And, you know, I was able to work in his cabinet and produce quite a bit of completed tasks that were placed in front of me. So, you know, I look forward to continuing discussions with the premier after I move on from politics and keeping them highlighted of what's issues are down in southwestern Ontario.
You mentioned cabinet. Was the fact that you were not in the latest cabinet, did that impact your decision here at all?
I mean, there's many things that played into that role, that decision of whether or not I was to stay on. I do understand in politics, though, that people get moved around quite a bit. And some days are bad days and some days are good days. I don't think it was a permanent removal from cabinet if I was to stay in government for a couple more terms. But I wouldn't say that was definitely the reason why I'm not running again, no.
You're a pharmacist, obviously. Did that give you a unique perspective into sort of some of the challenges that a government may face during a pandemic? You yourself were doing vaccinations during the last few months here, or certainly at the peak height of our vaccinating times here in Ontario.
Yeah, I think my background did help on numerous fronts, understanding community health care. My interactions as a health critic prior to becoming government, I was able to offer an opinion both in cabinet and caucus of what the reflection of everyday life would be for people dealing with this pandemic. It was a tremendous honor that the health units and a few pharmacies let me participate in the vaccination clinics. I hope to get back into the health units clinic later this month after you know, we get things straight away here at the office. And you know, I think being a pharmacist has been just a tremendous help overall, being an MPP and being part of this community.
Another part of your job, and you mentioned this in your statement, and this is something that you and I talked about quite a bit when I was doing the radio show, and I talked about this with Ryan's mom when I was doing the radio show, is Ryan's Law, which is something that you said you were pretty proud of from your time in politics, and you should be. The fact that this is something that kind of had to be a little bit of a battle, and you got it passed when you were in opposition, not in government, is a pretty big deal. For those who don't remember, tell us about Ryan's Law and sort of the process leading us to that.
Well, sure. Ryan's Law enshrines in legislation students' right to access their emergency medication at school at all times. It won't be locked up in a cupboard at any time. It also outlines education planning for staff to deal with students with asthma, and a record will be kept on site by the principal for people or children that do have asthma. You know, that resulted because of the unfortunate death of Ryan Gibbons at Stratfordville Public School a number of years ago. And his mother, Sandra, came and spoke to me and told me about what happened. Ryan was unable to get access to his inhaler at the time. It wasn't on him at that time. And he died of an asthmatic attack at school. That won't happen ever again. That law has been changed thanks to the work of Sandra Gibbons in supporting me and the legislature at the time. Unanimous passage of my bill. Students will now be able to carry their inhaler at all times, and there will be a spare on site as well due to the legislation. So I'm quite proud of that work. I think Sandra should be proud of that work. Her advocacy from the grassroots has made change in the system, and kids in our school system are that much safer, and has probably saved some lives.
I think that there's a very, very good chance to save some lives, and it's too bad that it wasn't the rule before that this was allowed. I still wonder how that was allowed to be the case, but we've gotten through it. But the key thing here that you mentioned is this was passed unanimously, and you did this sort of from the opposition bench, which that's kind of a rarity to get something like this passed unanimously from the opposition bench, right?
Yeah, I was really proud of that. I mean, we're at a time, I think there was only maybe one or two opposition bills that passed during that part of Parliament. And this type of bill that I think we got passed changed quite heavily policy throughout the school system. And that's usually what happens with government bills, not opposition bills. So that's why I think it was a good piece of legislation. It was common sense, and unfortunately, sometimes in politics, you have to legislate common sense because it can get lost. People don't see the forest for the trees, and I'm glad that they all came on board and helped me make that change.
You know, I've also noticed that the common sense needs to be legislated from time to time, so that's interesting. Let's talk quickly about what's next for you. So as of the end of February, you are no longer the member of provincial parliament. We'll decide who the next person is in June. We can talk about that towards the end here. But you yourself, what are you going to be doing when this comes to an end, your time in politics is over?
Yeah, right now I'm just focused on wrapping things up here at the constituency office, seeing what my options are out there. I'm still a licensed pharmacist. I might be heading back in that field. It's open for me. I'm definitely staying in Elgin County and being part of that community. So we'll see what arises for me come March. But right now the focus is just making sure things are set in place, that the constituents will be taken care of, and lead up to the next election. Do whoever fills my shoes, I will be able to keep going where I've left them.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Have people expressed interest to you as far as, oh, I want to be the progressive conservative candidate next time around, or whatever it happens to be?
Yeah, I've had a handful of people reach out. I'm sure I won't be part of that selection process. I just refer them to the association to decide how they're going to move forward with the nomination process. I've spoken to people as well who are interested in running in for other parties. They're just asking a perspective of a life of an MPP. So I hope we get someone in place that's going to look after Elgin, Middlesex, London. And if they do, I will be there to support them in their job.
No matter which party they represent?
Hey, whoever the people this riding elect, if I can be of any benefit to that person to make life better for people in Elgin, Middlesex, London, I'm going to be part of that. My public life days are coming to an end, and I'm going to be a regular citizen again. So my focus is going to be on the best thing for our riding at the end of the day. So it's up to the people who they elect, and then I will support whoever's been elected.
I certainly understand that, and I would feel the same way. Anything else, Jeff, that you want to add, that you want to tell people in the community about or mention before we wrap up our chat here?
Yeah, I just want to take the opportunity to thank everyone in the community. Whether you voted for me or not, you were there to support me through the good and bad times. I want to thank my constituency staff, who I think have created a great system of service to the people of the riding. I don't think it'll be matched going forward unless that same team stays together. And I want to thank my family, my wife, my daughter, and my family for their unconditional support during the past 10 years and keeping me grounded and focused on what truly matters, and that's the people of this riding.
I think that's a fantastic spot to leave it. Jeff, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for your service to the province over the last, how many years are we talking about? When did you first get elected?
2011.
So yeah, we're over a decade now. So time flies, I guess. Eh? you so much for your service to the province over the last decade plus, and I appreciate you talking to us today.
Thanks very much, Craig, and thanks for everything you do for our community as well.
Jeff Urick, the soon-to-be former member of Provincial Parliament for Elgin, Middlesex, London. All the time we have on the podcast this week. Thank you very much for listening. And you can, of course, download us, find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and londonnewstoday.ca as well. Oh, also, classicrock981.com. Thank you for listening to this edition of the podcast. We'll talk to you on Friday here on the Craig Needles Podcast.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of Blackburn Media.